essentially, it was a U.S. Justice Department lawsuit against Microsoft for a variety of anti-competitive practices that stifled competition and stifled innovation. The core of the case centered around the browser. At the time, there was a big war between Microsoft's Internet Explorer and Netscape Navigator, which was the predominant browser at the time. And what the case alleged and what the courts mostly agreed with was that Microsoft had engaged in a bunch of unsavory, predatory, anti-competitive practices to try to stop Netscape from succeeding and try to push Internet Explorer forward. So instead of competing on the merits, innovating well, making a better product, getting it out to people in the right competitive way, they took steps to hobble Netscape and its ability to get it out. There were some other parts of it. They did similar things to try to stop the spread of Java, which was Sun's programming language, which offered the possibility that people could write applications which would then run anywhere. Their slogan was write once, run anywhere. And so Microsoft took steps to try to stop that. They took some steps to stop Intel from developing software that they thought would compete with them. But it was primarily, it was all around trying to protect the Windows operating system and the huge monopoly that they had in Windows from threats from the browser and Java and other things.
So what were the conditions that led up to Microsoft exhibiting this kind of behavior?
So they had had a very strong position and eventually a monopoly in Windows for a number of years before the browser war started. Netscape introduced its first graphical user interface browser in 1995, and at that point Microsoft was really well positioned, had a very strong monopoly in Windows, and they saw the existence of an independent browser, and especially an independent browser in Java, working together as a real threat to their operating system. And so at that point, and they had also been a bit slow to recognize the importance of the Internet, how the Internet was going to change everything in terms of computing and how and where people interacted with information. And so they were scrambling to catch up, very worried about losing the browser battle, which they then worried would undermine their operating system monopoly. And so it was that development, really, the development of the Internet and then of consumer-friendly browsers that were going to be used, by the great mass of people in the public, that really frightened them and spurred them to take a bunch of steps to try to stop it and make sure that didn't happen.
And so what were the immediate effects for Microsoft of the ruling?
So as with most court cases, the ruling stayed tied up on appeal and then implementation for a while. The original court decision ordered that Microsoft, the company, should be broken up into two parts, and the appeals court disagreed with that and said, no, we're not going to break up the company. And instead what happened was there were a whole variety of restrictions placed on Microsoft about what it could not do, mostly what it could not do, a few things that it had to do in terms of how it competed going forward. And essentially it was saying, stop all of the bad things that you've been doing. So, you were forcing customers who wanted Windows, which is pretty much everyone, because Windows was a monopoly, you're forcing them to also take Internet Explorer when they get Windows by making it, tying together or bundling together the browser with the operating system. And you have to give consumers and computer makers, OEMs like, HP and Dell and others, you have to give them the option of, in one way, getting rid of Internet Explorer so they could put another browser on and people wouldn't be confused. So that was part of it. They had done other things in terms of distribution deals with Internet service providers like AOL and others that favored Internet Explorer and really made it very hard for Netscape to get distributed. So they were ordered not to do those kinds of things. And then in addition, they were ordered to reveal all of the APIs, all of the application programming interfaces that applications use to talk to and interoperate with the Windows operating system so that other developers were on equal footing with Microsoft's own developers to make their browsers or other products work. And a similar obligation that they had to license the communications protocols that allowed servers to talk to the Windows desktop. So, Microsoft had a monopoly in the desktop. They built special features into that that only their servers could talk to so that their servers could then work a lot better with the monopoly Windows desktop, and the other people who made servers, you know, Sun and Novell and IBM and others, couldn't do that because Microsoft wouldn't give them access to this sort of secret sauce on the operating system. So they were ordered to reveal all of that. There's a huge debate still about whether the settlement, the consent decree that ended the case and imposed these requirements on Microsoft, actually made much difference in the marketplace or not. Mm-hmm. Certainly didn't take away Microsoft's monopoly over Windows. I mean, their position on the desktop is a little weaker now than it was 12 years ago, but still incredibly strong. So mm-hmm. it didn't immediately undermine their monopoly. But, you know, at least my opinion is it did make it possible for Mozilla and then Firefox to really, combined with, you know, lots of great work and innovation and engineering on their side, made it possible for them to succeed and gain a pretty good share of the market. You know, Internet Explorer is still the dominant browser, but Firefox has, I don't know, 25-30% of the market now, which is a huge number compared to, you know, at the time of the trial and the time of the settlement, Internet Explorer had something like 90 or 95% of the browser market. So I think it's made it possible. And it's probably, again, my opinion, other people disagree, it's also probably made it possible for companies like Google to do some of the things they've done and to succeed with, you know, offerings in the cloud and with their own Gmail products and other things that really do compete with either Windows or with Microsoft's own Office suite. It would have been much easier for Microsoft to find ways to head those off had it not been restricted from anti-competitive activity by the settlement. So had some effect, I think, made the world better, but it was much, much less than what the government was asking for and what might have been.
Yeah, it's an interesting area to kind of do thought experiments around, because it seems like there were so many avenues that somebody might have taken Microsoft from. And in that respect, the Department of Justice chose a very narrow view, you know, and the FTC, like, they chose a very narrow view of what to target.
Right.
So in that way, you could say that the, you know, the outcome, the settlement, the remedies, you know, probably didn't have the effect that maybe a lot of the marketplace was hoping for.
Right, right. Certainly very narrow in terms of what a lot of people hoped for. And yeah, it's so hard. Part of what makes this area so exciting, either, you know, when you're looking back to say what effect did this have, or when you're looking ahead, when you're thinking, all right, what do we, you know, what is the effect of this particular conduct going to be, or what is the effect of this kind of restriction on a company going to be? It's so hard to know what the but-for world would be. So, you know, one big debate in the Microsoft case was, well, if Microsoft hadn't done all of these predatory things, if they had just gone out and competed hard on the merits, would Netscape and Java really have taken off and become an independent platform and undermine Microsoft's operating system? And the answer is there's no way to know, right? It's a sort of counterfactual that we can never test. And so, you know, the best we can do is look at what people, you know, who people in the business, people whose money was on the line, thought about it. And part of the, a lot of the Microsoft case was built on Microsoft's own documents and their own emails, where Bill Gates and others said, hey, this browser thing is really scary. You know, Gates wrote that an independent browser, you know, threatened to commoditize the underlying operating system, so that it wouldn't really matter if you were running, you know, Windows or Linux or something else, it would all be the same. So they, at least in their business planning, took it very, very seriously. And I think that's the best you can do. It's very hard to make these predictive judgments. And yet, part of what's challenging and exciting about antitrust is it's typically called on to make predictive judgments. Mm-hmm. You know, you're asked to try to divine ahead of time what the effect of a merger is going to be on competition that would have occurred but for the merger. Or you're asked to evaluate, you know, what difference these kinds of contracts or this kind of design of a product, what effect has this had? And more importantly, what will it have going forward on the market? And, you know, I think antitrust can do a pretty good job of that, but you can never prove it. You know, you can never sort of watch the video of what would have been otherwise and say, oh, well, okay, so that would have been the alternate world.
Right. And the other thing that's interesting to explore is the idea of intent, because intent in some respects is something that's very easy to prove. You can have an email trail or conversations that say, yes, we were going out there just to squash Netscape Navigator. You know, in some respects, how do you parse out what is simply trying to you know, advance your company and be more strategic, and what is going out and actively trying to squash your competition?
Right. No, that's a great question. And the courts have, over time, have gotten to a position where they recognize that, you know, intent evidence alone really, we're never going to base a sort of ruling that a company has violated the antitrust laws just on intent. And in fact, you really want companies to say, we're going to try to kill our competitor. We're going to do everything we can to kill. You know, that's competition. We like, you know, good, hard, aggressive, vigorous competition, whether it's in, you know, innovation and designing new products or figuring out better, cooler ways to get them to consumers or better pricing. You know, we want that. And often the result of that is your competitor gets killed. That's great if you do it on the merits. And even sometimes young companies may say, well, you know, we want to cheat. We're going to try to do these, you know, predatory things to win. But just because they want it doesn't mean that it really happens. So you still have to look at what was the actual practice and the actual effect. But what courts have said is intent evidence can be a good indication, can sort of tell you how the business really works. You can't say, well, just because somebody meant a bad thing, they're guilty of an antitrust violation. Mm-hmm. But you can say, you know, some of the Microsoft documents suggested that Microsoft believed if it tied Internet Explorer and Windows together more tightly, that would close off Netscape. It wouldn't be able to get distribution. That it knew the best, the key distribution channel was the OEM, the computer maker channel, and if it could lock that up, it would win. So the mere bad intent isn't enough, but the fact that Microsoft believed that is really good evidence that, you know, doing something in that channel was in fact going to have a big effect. So it gets used to reveal how the business works and what the impact of certain decisions would be, but not so much, well, you had a bad thought, therefore mm-hmm. you must be guilty.
Well, and the idea of a monopoly plays a big role, I imagine, as well. Right. And what is the how did this play in Microsoft, and what is the definition of a monopoly?
So for most of the kinds of violations that were at issue in Microsoft, and most of the kind that we tend to think about in the high-tech and the computer industry, you really have to have monopoly power to start. Most of these are monopolization or attempted monopolization under what's called Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And so it's something that a big company can do by itself. It doesn't have to enter into an agreement with someone else, which is sort of the other kind of antitrust violation. And so things like tying one product to another, or things like you know, trying to close off certain distribution channels, or trying to spread, you know, in the case of Microsoft, you know, deceiving developers about its own version of Java and using that to sort of poison the cross-platform nature of Java. Those are all things a company can do by itself to maintain a monopoly. And those are only illegal if the company has a monopoly to start with, or at least strong market power to start with. Which means, you know, typically the starting point is, you know, they have a very high market share, they have 70% or more. But that's really only a starting point, you know, and in the high-tech sector especially, you know, market positions can be very temporary. You know, somebody can rocket ahead. Think about MySpace, for example, or Friendster. You know, they early on, both of them did really well, and people thought, oh my gosh, nobody's ever going to unseat them. You know, MySpace is now a shadow of what it was. At one point, Facebook is really strong and dominant, but the technology is so dynamic and new ideas and new products and new services come along so quickly that unless there's some real barriers to somebody taking over, you know, you can have a really strong position one day and you can lose it the next. And so antitrust tries to be really careful to say, before we're going to get concerned about unilateral conduct, about things that you do on your own as antitrust violations, we want to be sure that you really have a monopoly first. And in the Microsoft case, it seemed to us, Microsoft, you know, argued and argued and argued that they didn't, but ultimately the court, you know, found it pretty easy to say, of course they have a monopoly. They have a very high market share, over 90%. They've had it for a while. And there are very specific barriers we can point to that make it hard for any other operating system to come along and unseat them. You know, the fact that there are, you know, at that time, tens of thousands of applications that run on Windows and far fewer for other operating systems, as well as, you know, lock-in and training and lots of switching costs, really did make it very unlikely you know, even if somebody, so, you know, take Linux, for example. Linux is a great operating system, right? It's really wonderful in a lot of ways. If you were doing it purely on the technical merits, it might well unseat Microsoft. But huge advantages for Microsoft in terms of built-in, a huge built-in network of applications, you know, massive number of device drivers and, you know, interoperability. So there's this whole world that would be very, very hard for someone else to duplicate. You know, other companies that have a very high share may or may not have that. So if you think now about Google with, you know, they have a 70-ish percent of the search market. You know, Facebook is incredibly strong in social networking. But there are, I think, tough questions that you'd have to ask, you know, up front before you say, but they're a monopoly. You know, what is it that keeps Google at the 70% position? You know, their argument is competition's just a click away. You know, people could go to Bing tomorrow or they could go to Yahoo tomorrow. There's nothing that keeps them locked into us. You know, and you can debate that. It's good for debate. But before we start to get worried about a company's sort of predatory actions, we first need to be sure that they actually have a monopoly position to start with.
How do you define these markets? Because it seems to me that you could say that Linux and Windows are both in the browser market, but Linux, you know, has a pretty specific user base compared to Windows. One is more consumer and one is more of a kind of geeky bent.
Right.
So how do they define these markets?
Right. Huge question. And that's always the sort of $64,000 starting question. You know, you have to have some pretty good definition of what market you're talking about before you can decide, does a company have power in this market or not? You know, for example, Microsoft tried to argue that the market really should be all software. And if you do that, you know, it had a very small percentage. And that's crazy, of course. But you could also make a really, really narrow specific market. That's probably crazy. So it's very tricky in software markets, especially to define what the market is, because they're so malleable, right? You can tweak a software product so it, you know, works for this group better or, you know, maybe works for a lower group. Typically, it's about substitutability. You know, could consumers who are using a product switch to a different product if they didn't like what they had, if prices of the one they had went up, if the quality went down? Is there a realistic substitute to which they could switch in the short term? So, you know, if you're talking about Windows users, Linux is an acceptable substitute. You know, it may be that it's especially valuable to, you know, more techie users and people with more specialized knowledge, and the really average consumer probably won't do it. But for a significant number of people, they could switch. You know, if you take some, you know, much more esoteric operating system, or if you say, for example, during the trial, Microsoft argued that we shouldn't be looking just at desktop computers. We should be considering, you know, handheld devices and all sorts of other ways of computing in the same market. And particularly in 1998, that didn't make any sense, right? No one was going to use, you know, a very crude, at that point, handheld device or, you know, some other, like a high-end workstation or something to do the same thing that they would use their PC for. It's just not going to happen. And if you look, even, you know, up until very recently, you know, handheld devices and smartphones and so on have been almost exclusively sort of complements to things that people will use in addition to a desktop. Now, that may well change as the power gets, you know, even greater and they become more ubiquitous. But the question you have to ask is, you know, now and for the foreseeable future, the next 2, 3, 4 years, something like that, what are the realistic options that consumers have to switch to? And if something, you know, realistically could substitute for what you're looking at in the short term, then that should be included in the market as well. But the specifics of it get, you know, can get, as you can imagine, very complicated and very hard to sort out. Yeah.
If there's a third moon of Jupiter rising over Aquarius. And
The gravitational pull is just right. Exactly.
Well, then let's, there's a lot of experimentation we can do around this. But getting back into the history a little bit, people cite US v. Microsoft as the big one. But I wonder, has there been another antitrust case since then that eclipses it, or, you know, maybe that people don't talk about as much, but has a big significance?
There really hasn't been one that's sort of in that league, I don't think. I mean, there have been, you know, obviously big cases. The FTC's lawsuit against Intel, which has dragged on for a while, which looks like it's, you know, at least according to press reports, about to settle, is obviously really big in terms of potential impact on the industry. But there were a few things about the Microsoft case that I think make it pretty unique and something that won't be duplicated for a while. And part of it was new, right? It was the first monopolization case, especially in the kind of consumer computing and software business. You know, there had been antitrust cases against IBM before for, you know, mainframes and very big corporate stuff. But this was the first time in what was really a very dynamic, very fast-moving consumer technology space that antitrust sort of came to bear in such a big way. And there were huge questions. I mean, a lot of people were writing and commenting early in the case, before the case was resolved, that antitrust really had no role to play in highly dynamic, innovation-driven industries, that the markets just moved too fast, antitrust could never figure it out, could never, you know, get it right and keep up. And there were even antitrust skeptics who said that we really never needed antitrust in those markets, that because the markets moved so fast, because there was always, you know, a flood of new innovation going on, a lot of new ideas, any problem, any anti-competitive behavior would be quickly swept aside by the next, you know, big thing. So if early social networking site was doing things to lock in customers, who cares? Because then you'd have Facebook with a whole new model come along and wipe them out. Well, I think one of the things about the case is I think it proved most of that wrong. Again, there's still people who disagree and people who are very skeptical, but I think for the most part, people recognize that the case showed us that sometimes the market doesn't work. I mean, that's what antitrust is all about. It says for whatever reason in this case, because of monopoly power and bad behavior, the market isn't working and it can't correct, and so consumers will be harmed. And in the Microsoft case, you know, Microsoft had a monopoly and it was durable. It was not going to get swept away very easily, and especially if Microsoft was allowed to kill any new threat that came along that, you know, might have some chance of sweeping it away. And so in a case like that, the market wasn't working right and antitrust really was needed. I think that was a huge lesson that the case taught, because a lot of people really weren't sure about that or didn't believe it. And the other was that, you know, antitrust and antitrust enforcers can figure these very complicated things out and actually intervene and figure out what's wrong and do the right thing. And I think the case, you know, proves mostly that we can. I think, you know, the case really got to the heart of what Microsoft was doing. It identified the bad practices. It sorted out very different competing stories about whether this was bad or not. Now, again, people argue that the remedy was much too little, much too late, mm-hmm. and really didn't change anything. And that's a fair point to debate. But in terms of saying, can the government and the courts investigate a situation, figure out what's wrong, and actually move to try to fix it, I think the case showed that we can. And finally, there's a real tension. Part of what makes antitrust in these, you know, dynamic, innovative industries so much fun, but so challenging, is there's a huge tension, because you don't want to intervene. You don't want antitrust to come in and stop companies from doing something unless there's really a problem. The last thing you want is for antitrust to deter a company from fighting really hard and competing really aggressively. The last thing you want is to chill innovation and have a company like Google or Apple or somebody say, oh, well, we have this really great idea, we have this great new product, but, you know, I don't know, the DOJ or the FTC might think it's a problem, so we're not going to do that. You really don't want them to think that unless it really is anti-competitive. And so you need to be able to separate out hard, vigorous competition and super innovative behavior from predatory, anti-competitive behavior. And again, I think the case did a good job of that. I think the case sorted out and said, no, these things that Microsoft is doing are bad. And given Microsoft's position in the market, it's hurting consumers, it's hurting innovation, it's slowing down progress. And so we need to intervene. But, you know, there's certainly other cases. You know, you can imagine a lot of cases where even if specific competitors are getting hurt, even if specific competitors are complaining that, oh, this is terrible, we can't compete, that's just because it's good, hard competition, and they're not doing a good enough job, and they're not being innovative enough, and you don't want to intervene there. So knowing when to step in and when not to is hugely important. And again, I think the Microsoft case showed us that we can figure that out, but we have to be really careful.
One last question. If you had to say there would be, you know, an analog of the US v. Microsoft situation today, what would that be?
Yeah, I think someday there will be one. I have to say, I don't see one on the horizon today. So, you know, lots of people are concerned about talking about some of the conduct of Apple in particular with, you know, being very proprietary about apps for the iPhone and the iPad, you know, and controlling what runs there and excluding other products and so on. And some of that behavior begins to look similar. But there's a huge threshold question first that you know, I don't know the answer to, but I think it's definitely more complicated, about whether Apple has sort of durable monopoly power over smartphones or over, you know, however you define the market for the iPad, you know, over handheld tablets, such that this behavior is really troubling and really going to hurt consumers. You know, if, for example, if it was a brand new market, you know, if smartphones didn't exist and Apple, you know, basically had the first one, which is not too far from what happened. Certainly in the early days, you wouldn't say that, oh my gosh, they're excluding competitors or they're taking these predatory actions, because consumers potentially would have a lot of other choices. Lots of other people could develop one. On the other hand, a point could come and may come, and some would say even has come, where Apple would have such a strong position in the market and the chance of sort of competition in this space would be so limited that then you would say, now it has a monopoly, now these actions are really troubling and are really harmful to consumers. But you have to define that point. We had the same, you know, there were lots of arguments about the iPod and iTunes music distribution and the fact that, you know, originally music from the iTunes store with its DRM only worked on the Apple iPod and not somewhere else, and was that locking in the monopoly? But you know, there's has always been a fair amount of competition, a number of other choices for music players and portable music formats.
Right, and in that case, you saw that Apple and the music publishers responded
right
before anybody had a
chance. Yeah, and eventually they sort of walked away from that. So, you know, and the same thing with Google. You know, again, people there are a few antitrust lawsuits now pending against Google that allege that, you know, they manipulated search results in a certain way to shut out competitors. And a lot of people sort of concerned, you know, this idea of search neutrality is now getting thrown around, usually rhetorically. But the idea that, you know, Google may be harming competition by misusing its power in search. And you know, I think time will tell. I'm skeptical at this point because I do think that the forces that give Google its current market share are much more ephemeral than the ones that protected Microsoft are. And there's a lot of possibility for, you know, new search engines, new technologies. You know, if Google starts to play games, starts to act in an anti-competitive way, the ability of competitors to come in and provide a choice is much greater. But those are the questions you have to sort out. So I don't see anything that's at all the equivalent today. You know, some of the allegations in the Intel case that the FTC has brought are similar. And I think Intel's position over microprocessors is certainly really strong and has been very durable. And the FTC, you know, has a very good argument in saying that that's monopoly and therefore this bad behavior is troublesome.
But that's something I don't know too much about. What's the behavior that Intel is exhibiting?
It's primarily restricting the ability of computer makers to use other chips, so essentially paying them very large amounts of money in terms of bonuses or rebates or so on in order to stay exclusive with Intel and not to source their chips from someone else. So it's not really competing. It's not making a better chip. It's not competing on the merit. It's essentially
just using their market power.
Yeah, it's essentially just trying to close off the channel so that, you know, if someone else makes a better chip, they can't get it adopted in the market because Intel is saying, oh, no, we'll offer you these big bonuses and these big incentives if you stay away. That doesn't really help consumers in the end, because it thwarts, you know, new developments and innovative work by new companies. You know, what you want to see is people who compete really hard and try to make an even better product. You want to see Intel respond by, you know, making the next generation of chips or tweaking its chips so that they're even faster or even more robust or even better, rather than sort of paying money to close off the means of distribution.
I've got two questions that are more of curiosity and postscript that might not be any part of this, but I'm recording anyway because I don't want to lose it.
You never know.
So one is about innovation in general. Why do we see big companies begin to chill when it comes to innovating?
So that's a great question. There's this huge debate in the sort of academic literature, the business school literature, the legal literature about what corporate structure, what size, what kind of company is best for innovation. And there's sort of this, you know, age-old fight. So the economist Joseph Schumpeter had this idea, you know, sort of creative gales of creative destruction where, you know, one wave of innovation would come along and wipe out everything that came before. And he eventually came to the view that it was really big companies and maybe a few big companies that were best suited to innovate. Lots of other people have the view that, you know, in fact, maybe smaller companies or at least, you know, a number of firms competing with each other are the best drivers of innovation. And so there's this real question mark about how much competition in innovation drives innovation versus how much it's just having the money and the resources. And there's no clear answer to that. I mean, I think the better view by far is that, you know, at least some level of vigorous competition gets you much more innovation than having one or two big companies. And you see examples of big companies that are plenty innovative, and there are plenty of theoretical reasons why even a big company, and even a company with monopoly power, might still innovate and might even still innovate hard. But there are also a lot of forces in a big company that push against innovation. So, you know, you may have a monopoly product like Windows that you suddenly have a very strong interest in protecting. So even if you have some really cool... There's Clayton Christensen, who's a professor at the Harvard Business School, has a book from a few years ago called The Innovator's Dilemma, which is all about, you know, what do you do if you're a big company with a strong position in the market and you see that there's a new thing coming along that's probably going to unseat your big product? You know, you have two basic choices. One, you can just try to extract every penny out of the thing you have for as long as you can and try, you know, ideally, legally, to slow down the adoption of this new thing, knowing that eventually you're going to lose out. Or you can try to innovate yourself to be part of the next wave so that you then capture the replacement sales that come from the new thing. But by doing that, the sooner you do that, the more you begin to cannibalize your own sales. Mm-hmm. And so you face this real dilemma. You know, what do you do? And I think that often happens. Big companies you know, have parts of their business they need to protect, and so they can't be as nimble. Whereas a new startup, all they care about is winning this new war, is building this one new cool product, making it as good as possible, and as quickly as they can, knocking off all the old entrenched competition. And part of it is just bureaucratic inertia. You know, as companies get bigger, it's harder for them to be really nimble. It's harder for them to respond really quickly to what's happening in the market. They don't have the same sort of just fluidity that a smaller company might have. Though, you know, there are a lot of reasons to think that Google, even as it's gotten much, much larger, has continued to do a good job of being innovative.
So Apple's iPhone app development process has come under a lot of fire. Part of that has to do with the lockdown that they have on the just the operating system on the iPhone. We saw last week that the Library of Congress had just squashed Apple's wish to keep the DMCA responsible for keeping that lockdown. So people can now jailbreak their iPhones with impunity. And who knows if Apple might try to challenge that or figure out another way. But my curiosity is this, like if you develop an app for that works on the iPhone's dominant operating system and they reject you, so you go off to the black market, which is the jailbroken version of the iPhone, you can still sell your app, but are you engaging in illegal activity technically if you do that? And if so, doesn't that play a role in kind of like squashing innovation of app developers in a way?
Right, right. So good question. As for the illegal, I don't think, I haven't thought about it from that standpoint too much. I don't think, certainly the developer who develops an app that's either rejected by Apple or who doesn't even submit their app to Apple for approval, I don't think simply by doing that they're breaking any laws. Now, before this new exemption by the library, the Librarian of Congress, if the app itself, jailbroke the iPhone, you know, essentially worked around the protections on the iPhone to make it run, that might have been seen as a violation of the DMCA. Although usually it wasn't the app that did that; it was the user, you know, using some piece of software that would jailbreak their own phone. So probably not illegal in that sense. There are still ways, as you suggest in your question, that Apple can try to stop this, whether it's, you know, contractual, whether it says, you know, we're licensing to you the operating system for this, and in, you know, as part of that license, you agree not to run certain applications, you agree only to get things from the iTunes store, you know, however they do it, there's still ways they could try to do that. But that it's this, but apart from the legality question, you know, it's this closed proprietary approach to its ecosystem. It's basically saying, you know, we, Apple, will be the arbiter of everything that can run on this platform. And we think that's a good thing. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs defends that and says, you know, I think that's the way to avoid big security problems. I think that's the way to give users a much better experience. They're not going to be flooded with porn. They're not going to be flooded with spam. They're not going to have to worry about malware the same way that, you know, people on regular PCs and frankly, regular Macs do. You know, that's a plausible argument. Now, there are plenty of people, you know, Jonathan Zittrain and others, who say that's the wrong approach. That's bad, ultimately, for innovation. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, it could be bad for speech. If you imagine, if this really became dominant, you know, if everybody was using an iPhone and an iPad, that was the main way that all of us accessed information in the Internet, at least, you know, in a non-desktop way, then it starts to be troubling from, you know, political and speech standpoints as well, right? If Apple says, well, no, we don't like, you know, we're not going to let this particular political group put their application and their speech on here. Mm-hmm. We're not going to let people who, you know, we're not going to let Republicans speak. We're not going to let libertarians speak. You know, those are extreme cases, but it starts to be scary when you have one intermediary that controls the content. And content can easily, you know, expand from just, you know, how safe is the application, how well engineered is it, to, you know, porn is a great example. You know, some people don't want an intermediary deciding what kinds of content they get to see on their device. So in a sense, you have two very different competing views of the right way to do this. And I think as long as consumers have a choice, as long as Apple doesn't have a monopoly, as long as there's healthy, vigorous competition for these kind of devices and these kind of operating systems. And again, we can debate whether or not there is or whether Apple is already in a pretty dominant position. But if there is vigorous competition, then I think, you know, the different approaches are fine. And let's let the market sort out whether consumers really want and consumers are really better off with a closed, kind of going back to the old walled garden approach where someone else decides these things for you and protects you, or whether consumers want the generative, open platform that has so many more possibilities. Where it gets troubling is when one company, you know, here Apple, but potentially anyone, gets such a strong position in the market that consumers don't really have a choice, that they're sort of forced to live in this world where Apple then makes the decisions. And then I think antitrust may have to play a role, particularly if Apple, you know, if it had a monopoly, if it were saying, you know, no, we're not going to allow competing browsers to run on here. We're not going to allow competing music players to run on here. And it really isn't the end of the day about quality. It's about we don't want the competition. We right. want to, you know, I think if that happens, then that's exactly where antitrust should step in.
That's actually a territory that that I'm interested in following up on, because there is a loophole that Apple uses in their software development, their app development process, that says that if you're a developer who develops anything that mimics, you know, a function that we've already built in, cooked into our iPhone, then we have the right to reject you. Right. And that's a huge, huge, huge thing. And I'm thinking specifically of a case that this might, you know, fall into. There's a developer, an app developer named Greg Hughes, who developed an app called Wi-Fi Sync, And basically, it's an app that allows you to sync with iTunes, sync up your apps and your music over a local Wi-Fi network. And it's a great idea for utility. Apple hasn't yet implemented something like that. But if tomorrow they decided that they wanted to, they'd have the complete right to. So far, Greg Hughes has made $10 a pop on this app on the black market of iPhone apps. But if Apple decided they wanted to do this, they'd essentially be eliminating their competition.
Right. Right. And again, you know, if there's competition in the market, if Apple doesn't really have a monopoly, then, you know, antitrust, I think, correctly says, that may be a bad idea, that may be a bad strategy, but consumers can recognize it and say, well, that's dumb. I don't want to have a device that does that, so I'm going to get an Android phone. I'm going to get something else that competes. Once you enter a world where the iPhone or the iPad is your more or less your only choice, a world like Microsoft had with Windows, then it's a different story. Then it really is about stifling competition. And, you know, it's not necessarily illegal. So there was always this huge debate in the Microsoft case about what things could Microsoft absorb into the operating system. Because if you look, you know, historically, every single operating system has added lots and lots and lots of features over time. You know, it should, it makes them better. The last thing you would want is an antitrust rule that says, nope, you got to freeze your product, whatever it is, you know, at point A. And then, you know, as long as somebody else somewhere in the world is making something else, you can't put it in. But the flip side of that is, you know, if you are Microsoft and you're incorporating the browser into your operating system and making it impossible for people to get rid of it or hide access to it so that they're likely to use others, and you have monopoly power, then that really becomes a problem. So I think, again, it comes down to, you know, at the point, wherever that comes, if it comes, that a court were to decide that Apple had monopoly power with the iPhone, then that sort of thing could be, you'd still have to prove that it affected competition and hurt consumers. You know, the mere fact that it puts, you know, this one developer out of business or hurt something, again, by itself isn't dispositive, because it might be, you know, might be that good, vigorous competition would have done that too. So you still have to show that it was anti-competitive and it had an anti-competitive effect. But we're much more skeptical of it once consumers have no other choice, once you have a sort of very dominant monopoly position.
But there could be an alternate interpretation, which might be just in terms of market definition, because it's fine to say, you know, that if I like that application, but I'm restricted from using it because of Apple's behavior, I can easily switch over to Android.
Right.
Well, I can't easily switch over to Android. Besides the fact that I'm an Apple fanboy, I've already invested, you know, a great deal of money in the Apple environment, and the iPhone environment, and the apps that are involved. I can't easily port that stuff over.
Right.
So if we define the market perhaps not as smartphones but as applications, then Apple develops their own applications. They have a ton of developers who are developing applications. Would that be possible to define that market? Is that a legitimate argument?
It's an argument you can make. I doubt it would prevail in the end. I mean, it gets really tricky, and again, it's really fun when you're talking about platforms, where the sort of market is a platform which is designed for lots of people to build applications for. So, you know, Windows is exactly that, right? It does some things in terms of, you know, running the hardware of the computer, but in a way what really matters is the sort of upward, outward facing part of it that says, you know, yeah, plug in any one of, you know, hundreds of thousands of applications here and we provide a platform for them to run. So when you're defining the market, you have to think about both of those. You have to think about, you know, so from the consumer's, the user's standpoint, what would you switch to? And you're right, you know, it's not like if you're an iPhone user, it isn't like you can say, you know what, I'm really not happy with the way Apple's doing business or the way this thing's working, I'm just going to switch. You know, you can do it, and part of the market definition is you have to look and say, how expensive is it, how likely is it that people would do it? But it isn't like you just download a new operating system onto your iPhone. You got to replace the hardware, and you've got to have new operating system software that comes with it, and all the applications that you've acquired presumably no longer work, and you have to acquire all of those. And so that begins to be to look sort of like the lock-in, sort of like the barriers that might protect a market position there. So, but those are the kinds of questions you would have to ask and sort out. And it gets very, very tricky. You have to, you know, really calculate just how easy versus how expensive is it to switch, given all of these things. And as a result, how likely is it that consumers would switch if they were, you know, a certain amount unsatisfied with the way things were. So it's a complex calculus.
Right.
So it could go the way you're suggesting. Or it could be that, you know, the more traditional way would be that the market would be this particular kind of device running this operating system. So it might be, you know, any kind of smartphone. And so it would include, you know, any sort of hardware that ran the Android software or an iPhone that ran the Apple software, because in a sense, at least for new users, those are interchangeable to a large extent. But then you still need to look and say, but would people switch from one to the other if they were unhappy with the one they had?
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely is an interesting calculus to experiment with. And I've already taken up too much of your time.
No, I'm glad to do it. I think, you know, these issues, whether it's Apple or Google or others, questions of market definition, questions of how much market power do they have and how durable is it versus how easily could they be swept aside. You know, I think we're going to be hearing about these and seeing these tested in lawsuits and so on for quite a while to come. So it's a really interesting thing to be watching for the next few years as it unfolds.
Well, it's interesting to know that the Department of Justice they kind of take a hands-off approach to this. And I wouldn't blame them, because it seems if they wade into the water too deep, then they'll be grasping all around to fight a lot of these cases.
Right, but it's, you know, again, it's an informed hands-off approach. And there are plenty of people, you know, on the conservative skeptical side who would say they're nowhere near hands-off enough. They should just stay completely off, because this is not an industry that ever needs them. I think, you know, the wiser view is the one they have, which is they look closely, they do investigate, so they were prepared to sue Google over its acquisition of its deal with Yahoo to do certain advertisements together. So they were ready to intervene there, rightly or wrongly. They've deferred in some other cases, and, you know, I think they're being asked frequently now, or urged by competitors at least, to look at other things Google is doing and get involved. And so I think they're careful. I think it's a little too early in the new antitrust administration to know, you know, ultimately how activists they're going to be, how much they're going to get involved versus how much they'll hold off. But I think they're, you know, my sense is they're looking very carefully, and they won't hesitate to get involved if they believe there really is an anti-competitive problem that's hurting consumers. But I also think they're savvy enough, and the people who do these investigations are both experienced enough, understand the technology, but also really get the need to be careful that they won't intervene unnecessarily, that they really will try to make a determination that there's really a problem before they do something. And I think that's what you want. You don't want, you know, how you calibrate it is hard, but you don't want too much intervention in the wrong cases, but you also don't want the enforcers to sit on their hands and let things happen that hurt consumers when they could intervene and should intervene. It's just a question of getting that line right, drawing it in the right place.
Well, thank you very much, Phil.
You're welcome. My pleasure.